I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to The Connection. I'm sure this has happened to you. A seemingly random song fragment starts playing over and over in your head. Now, it could be something irritating, like It's a Small World After All, or something catchy like Happy, sung by Pharrell Williams. These phenomena are called earworms, and they're very common. Our guest, Elizabeth Margulis, has been studying earworms as well as the power of music to evoke memories and emotions. She's director of the Music Cognition Lab at Princeton University. She joins us today on The Connection to talk about the importance of music for all of us, a kind of soundtrack for our lives. How tunes can transport us to our past, especially to our teenage years. How music can help people with dementia connect to lost memories. How culture influences musical taste and preferences. How music provides an avenue for communication for people with things like aphasia. How a sad song can make us feel better, and how music connects us to all our emotions. Elizabeth Margulis joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. Always great to have someone with us on the air. Nice to have you with us today on The Connection.
So great to be here. Thank you.
You're very welcome, and we have a lot to talk about. Can we think of music as a kind of universal language? Yes, we use different words, different rhythms, you know, different cadences, even different ways that we harmonize with each other. But should we think of music as a kind of universal language, something we all have?
It's interesting. Whenever I tell people what I do for a living, often the first thing they say in response is, music? I don't know anything about music. And if there's one thing that I've learned in a couple of decades of studying music in this way, it's that actually a capacity to respond to music, have understand it, make sense of it, have meaningful experiences with it, is actually hugely widespread. And I think we're often wrong about ourselves when we characterize ourselves as people who don't know anything about music.
Because it's all around us. I mean, even I'm thinking in utero, you know, we hear our mother's heartbeat. And that's the sort of rhythm of in utero life.
Absolutely. Babies can recognize songs that were sung to them in utero several months into life. Yeah, that's right. And babies that are a little bit older, it's interesting, they can discriminate between two songs that are hugely similar to one another, but only if it was a loved person, a caregiver, who sang it to them face to face. So it doesn't work if it's something they saw on TV or if it's a toy that was singing to them. So it turns out you can't just maybe put them on a mat and press a button and have the same effect. There's really something about that social connectedness that is inherent in the way we respond to music.
And I'm thinking about people who will sing to their baby in utero. I mean, that's kind of what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's great evidence that there's a special window of plasticity early in life where we can learn all kinds of interesting attributes of music that are much harder to learn as an adult. For example, complex meters. So if you think about tapping to a beat that's always regular versus one that has an extra kind of little note thrown in there sometimes, that's something all babies have the capacity to process. But if you don't play them music that takes advantage of that, they'll lose that ability. Whereas if you keep playing it, they retain the ability.
Plus, that really helps explain some of these cultural differences, why music in America, or let's say Western music and so-called Eastern music, is so very different when it comes to things like rhythm and chord structure, things like that.
Yeah, there's been really fun studies that used an experimental paradigm where people played a game of telephone with themselves. So they tried to tap to a rhythm. And then unbeknownst to them, the rhythm they were tapping to changed, and it was whatever they had tapped to the rhythm. So now they're trying to tap with themselves, tapping to the rhythm. And over a couple of iterations, this ends up in these categories, these small integer rhythmic patterns that vary immensely from culture to culture and just show how much the music we're exposed to shapes the way we hear new things.
I mentioned this in my introduction, but I have to say, and even preparing for this show, you know, I was taken back to many of my teenage year experiences, that there is something about music that takes us, like hearing a very specific piece of music, mm-hmm. can take us to a very specific part of our past. I mean, the feelings are there, the people are there, the images are there. It's so powerful and so strong. Why?
Well, it can feel like a reliving. And we do know that when people have pitted different kinds of cues against one another, so a musical excerpt versus a famous face or a taste of food, that the memories that music is cueing tend to be more vivid, more have more sensory details, more rich, more immediate. And in fact, some people view this as one of the evolutionary functions of music, that it's precisely the way that music immerses you in a memory or an imagined scene and really activates your emotions for real, such that you have practice with emotion regulation that may have been useful when people were living in larger social groups across evolutionary history. So it seems to be a really central function to music.
But, and also, I think there's something about adolescence. First of all, it feels like music is really important to teenage people. And I'm, you know, I certainly remember that. And that's also a time when we're trying to figure out who we are and what do we care about and what are our interests and who are our friends and what do we think about our family.
Absolutely. Music's a huge signature of identity, and in adolescence especially. And then across the lifespan, not only do we tend to like the music that we heard during our adolescence more late into adulthood and into older age, but we also have richer and more personal memories associated with music from our adolescence. But interestingly, there's also a secondary reminiscence bump for music from our parents' adolescence.
Oh, really?
And presumably, this comes from things that happen to you when you're too small to change the dial on the radio, and you're just subjected to your, you know, what your parents love, which is the music from their own adolescence. And so that's the way it kind of propagates from generation to generation.
So it's good, right? I mean, we are passing things on to our children.
Sure. And then that's connective tissue with your parents, right? Yeah.
I remember our son, he was probably still a baby. And when he would hear the theme music to All Things Considered, he would kind of, you know,
how adorable and appropriate.
But it was this very immediate response to something that was so very familiar to him.
Yeah. It's funny that I'm saying this casually, and yet, you know, my 10-year-old is just obsessed with 80s music, and I don't know why I have not thought about that in relation to secondary
reminiscence. Because that's your music, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yes. I mean, obsessed to the point that at his recent birthday party, we went to an 80s arcade, and he insisted on Bon Jovi the whole time, which, you know, was not very popular in the car.
But I think it's interesting that some parents feel as if, you know, listening to their children's music, they, you know, they don't like it, they're critical, it's loud, it's noisy, but that their children are hearing the music that they grew up with, that it's working on them subliminally.
Yeah, yeah. It's not really fair that it doesn't go back the other way.
Exactly. But it's interesting to compare then music, which is obviously part of hearing. And there are other senses that will take us to our past. I mean, you can, you know, have certain taste experience.
Like the Proust Madeleine.
Yeah. I mean, I've never had La Madeleine, but I know that feeling. Or certain smells will take us to our past. You know, I remember being in a house that smelled like old books, and I thought, oh my God, that is such a vivid childhood memory.
Yeah, I think what's extra about music is that it keeps going and it keeps changing dynamically. So there's this kind of scaffolding for those temporal aspects of memory where that's maybe less the case when it's a static image or kind of a single smell or something like that. I think it's just the richness of the cue and its temporal unfolding can kind of sustain and carry the memory maybe in special ways.
Plus, music is also about movement, right? I mean, who isn't like tapping their foot or nodding their head when you're hearing almost any kind of music?
Exactly. So even if you try to put people in an fMRI scanner, and I mean, if you've ever been in one, you know that there's not like it's not comfortable. You know, you're lying very still. But if you play the music with a beat, there's still activity in the parts of the brain that control your motor system. So there's a very tight link between the auditory system and the motor system. That means that when we're listening to music, we kind of can get swept up into it. Feel like we're moving, feel like we're participating, even if we're not literally moving around.
But do you think that's why it's so provocative and evocative? Because of our body connection to the music?
No question. Just that sense of participation, that sense of being drawn along is key to so many transportive experiences of music. Absolutely.
Well, my most favorite piece of classical music is Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet.
Oh, right.
And sometimes I feel like when I'm listening to that I'm going to go crazy.
I'm thinking of the Montagues and Capulets.
Absolutely. But yeah. I'm just going to go crazy, but I feel, in a good way, but I feel that so strongly in my body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have a graduate student, actually, Karen Christensen, who is a Philadelphian, and her dissertation project is all about the movements people imagine while they're listening to music. And she's really finding that a huge part of just the spontaneous imagining that people sustain while they're listening has to do with imagery, kinesthetic imagery of themselves moving.
Of themselves moving. Yeah. Because how can you not? In a way, I mean, if you look at dance or music around the world, you know, you see people are in movement, in connection.
Yeah. And I try to remember that when I'm in a concert hall and there's somebody, like at a classical concert, there's somebody next to me who can't, you know, like they're like conducting in their lap or something. Like, you have to say bless. Like that's, you know, understandable.
So where does music get kind of computed in our brain? How does it affect our brain?
A really interesting fact about music listening is that it's heavily distributed throughout the brain. And in fact, people who have a bunch of musical training, the two sides of their brain talk to each other better. So the parts of the brain that connect the hemispheres are better structured and more robust. A really important aspect to music listening is just the way it brings into play all of these areas that are devoted to other things and make them talk to each other. So as we talked about the auditory system and the motor system, but also reward circuitry. So think about dopaminergic systems where, you know, you anticipate something and then get this kind of pleasurable release when it happens. And all of these kind of are working in concert, which is one of the ideas about why music training and music experience can have these kind of protective effects across the lifespan and into aging.
Because it's kind of diffuse in the brain in a way.
Exactly. It's forcing you to coordinate all these different parts of your brain and make them talk to each other and work together.
Oh, but does it, I mean, when it comes in, does it go someplace versus when it goes out?
So, so there you've highlighted an important distinction between perceiving music and making music. And in our culture, it's much more common that people have a whole bunch of expertise perceiving music. And it's more asymmetrically distributed in the population where a smaller number of people regularly make music. Although it can be really interesting to look at everyday singing and what happens at birthday parties and, you know, yeah, people do have some abilities there that they really, I think, don't always know that they have.
Well, let's talk about everyday singing after this very short break. And today on the Connection, we are talking about music in all its forms, how it connects us to emotions, how it connects us to memory. We've got much more to talk about after this very short break. And our guest is Elizabeth Margulis, and she is director of the Music Cognition Lab, and that's at Princeton University. And we're going to talk much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and again, our guest today on the show is Elizabeth Margulis, and she has been doing some really fascinating research about the power of music to evoke things like memories and emotions. And again, she's director of the Music Cognition Lab at Princeton University. Well, you talked about singing right before the break.
Yes.
So let's talk about singing now that we're back on the air again. And I mean, I think singing, especially in a group, has this really powerful connective feeling. I mean, yes, because you're all working out of the same score. But nonetheless, what is going on when we're experiencing that?
Yeah, there's a lot of evidence about how powerful of a connector synchrony is, and just moving or even orienting in time in a manner that's entrained with the people around you. So there's all this research that, they had kids do things like either play a game where they were moving in sync together, or very similar game where there was no musical aspect and they weren't moving in sync, and found afterwards that the kids just help each other more if they'd moved in sync with each other for the period preceding that opportunity to help. And that's not a one-off study. There's actually a number of experiments that really convincingly demonstrate this relationship between synchronized movement, synchronized behavior, and social connectedness.
I mean, people look so happy when they're singing together. I mean, they look like they're having a really good time.
Yeah, there's also just the lovely experience of singing something yourself and hearing it all kind of resonate and come back to you from, you know, 100 different voices. It's just this kind of sense of purpose and connection that, seems really powerful.
We talked about music and memory and our teenage years and why a song can take us back to that time. But I'm also interested in the kind of research that looks at memory and things like dementia or even Parkinson's. I mean, the role of music and memory dealing with those conditions. Let me know. Where do things stand?
Yeah, well, one reason that people have, I mean, there's a lot of anecdotal evidence about music's efficacy in dementia, for example, and some research as well supporting that. And the basic idea is that when people listen to music from their adolescence, not only can it bring back a memory quite vividly, but often those memories are self-defining memories. They're not just an everyday memory, but it's a memory that really says something about who they are and who they were with and important kind of relationships. And so that's exactly the kind of memory that you would want to bring back for a person experiencing dementia. So that's one reason music is so useful, is just because it tends to be connected to those core memories.
But you're saying it doesn't bring back a traumatic memory. It brings back a good memory.
I mean, interestingly, that's so. Yes, actually, music evoked memories tend to be more positive on average because and more they tend to involve other people, because often when we're listening to music, we're doing it with other people and often on happy occasions. Okay, not always, but overall, there's a trend to more positive and more social kinds of memories from music.
I was looking at some coverage of Gabby Giffords, unbelievable. It was shot in the head by a random guy at an event when she was a member of Congress, and the bullet affected a very specific part of her brain. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she's still spending years, you know, trying to master language and movement, but music seems to play a really important role in some of her rehabilitation. How is that working?
That's right. For people who are experiencing aphasia, where they're unable to produce speech, often the capacity to sing is mysteriously preserved. So the same person who, you know, will sit there and not be able to say, you know, the word birthday, right, can sing happy birthday with little effort. And so there's an entire kind of clinical intervention built around this called melodic intonation therapy that strives to build on the preserved capacity to sing and gradually kind of pull out the musical aspects and make it more flatter and flatter and more like conventional speech. Wow. So it's really piggybacking on this retained musical ability to try to re-scaffold up the speech ability.
So the music part of the brain is essentially working, but then trying to translate that into more spoken word.
So basically, so you can imagine your auditory cortex. So you've got the part on the left and you've got part on the right. And so when the one on the left specializes more in these like faster kind of pitch transitions that happen when you're listening to speech, and the one on the right focuses more on these slower kind of frequency changes like happen in music. So you could have damage to the left side, but both, you know, the capacity for speech and language both rely on both hemispheres mm-hmm. too. So you can kind of capitalize on that, take what's preserved in the right side, and rebuild yeah. an ability for speech.
I also saw a little clip of her playing, I think it was a cello, playing the cello, that, you know, this is Gabby Giffords, just, you know, how music is an avenue for her for expression.
Yes. Yeah, there are a number of interesting experiences, examples there where people who had a lifelong habit of playing music had some of that preserved even into kind of really, really significant kinds of brain damage. So there's a famous pianist and conductor called Clive Waring in the UK who had just really profound amnesia. So truly can't recognize his wife. I mean, just really, really, really serious case, yet could sit down at the piano and play through, you know, wow. a Bach prelude.
Wow. Wow. Just because it's, but that tells us so much about the brain.
Yeah,
right?
That's exactly right. Yes, there are so many things about music that are like that. And it's interesting because cognitive science historically has looked more at language as this foundational kind of capacity of the human brain. And it's only in the last couple decades that people have thought to say, wait a minute, music is also a hugely yes. widespread yeah. and important human activity. And there are some things about the brain that you wouldn't have expected that are the case. And you can understand that if you look at music.
Sure, sure. Is there research looking into ADHD and music? I mean, sort of how to use music as a sort of roadway into the kind of unique thinking that can often come with ADHD?
Absolutely, because there's a whole set of demands, of executive function demands, that synchronizing with a rhythm and, you know, keeping control over what you're doing in time and thinking forward and backward as you're doing it. So there's a lot of work on designing interventions right. for ADHD that take advantage
of using a metronome, for instance.
Yeah, absolutely.
As a way of sort of just making it visual, but also making it auditory
yeah.
at the same time.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
I remember years ago, when it was time to study for a test, trying to get our son to sit and study for a test, which he did not want to do, of course, but using music and like throwing a tennis ball and singing the question and singing the answer, you know, I don't know if it made a big difference or not, but you know, it kept him occupied.
Yeah, we do this very naturally with babies. So if you think about what you do with your voice when you're talking to an infant, we tend to exaggerate our pitch contour, yeah. repeat ourselves a bunch, you know, talk at a higher pitch and slow things down. And all of those are ways that we're musicalizing our speech. Mm-hmm. And infants really respond preferentially to that kind of interaction.
We do that with our dogs and cats. Such a good dog.
Actually, there's a whole cottage industry of people who are looking comparatively across species at music perception, trying to understand where some of these abilities came from.
Yeah. Oh, excellent. Excellent. Why is it sometimes when we're sad and we listen to a sad song, we feel better?
Right. That seems like such a paradox.
It doesn't make sense. Right.
Part of it seems to be that a person can feel really alone with your sadness, right? If you think of a time... So it feels really dark. It feels really bad. Maybe it feels like nobody can understand you, right? And then sometimes you can put on the right song, and it feels like that person just gets it, right? And that you can kind of unload some of what you've been carrying into some imagined group context. So it does seem to like this surrogate social kind of experience, even if it's just you listening alone over headphones.
I just watched a documentary. It actually won an Oscar this year. It's titled "It's the Only Girl in the Orchestra." It's about double bass player Oren O'Brien, who was hired by the New York Philharmonic many, many decades ago, and she just recently retired. It's an intimate, touching portrait about her passion for music, also being part of the supporting cast of the orchestra, which is how she described it, mm-hmm. but also about her chaotic childhood. And one of the things she said that I wrote down is music helps us organize our emotions. And it was very true for her. Again, with this chaotic childhood, she focused on this instrument and played as a way to manage the feelings that she had.
I think that's the case for so many professional musicians, especially in the classical tradition, where you had to start really young. There had to be some reason that at a very, you know, small age, that you were obsessed in this way, right? Yeah. And gave the amount of hours that it requires just to lay down the motor pathways to have the capacity to continue in classical music.
Yeah. But that the emotions, it may not look that way, but that the emotions are there.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, absolutely. And you know, people often talk about music as ineffable in some way, that there's something about subjective emotional experience that music is capturing that kind of resists communication in speech.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and I do want to talk about earworms after this quick reintroduction. And again, today on The Connection, our guest is Elizabeth Margulis, and she's director of the Music Cognition Lab at Princeton University, has been doing some really fascinating research about music and how it does tap into our emotions, our memories. We'll be talking some more about some of the research that she has been doing, but one of the things that she has looked at are earworms. And just so our listeners know what we're talking about, how do you define earworm?
An earworm is a kind of involuntary musical imagery where usually a snippet from a tune pops into your head, a short bit, and just tends to get lodged there and repeat and repeat.
And it's very common, as you say.
Yes. I think sometimes people think that they have some special affliction, but it's absolutely widespread. And in fact, you can give people earworms with about a 75% success rate in a laboratory. So people are very susceptible to them in the right circumstances.
Well, we asked some of WHYY staffers to share their earworms with us, and let's take a listen to some of their picks.
When you're alone and life is making you lonely, you can always go downtown.
Now here.
We heard Tom's Diner by Suzanne Vega, Downtown by Petula Clark, Sabrina Carpenter's Espresso, the Muppet Babies theme song, We Like to Party by Venga Boys, and the Brady Bunch performing It's a Sunshine Day. And these were all suggested by our colleagues Kevin, Matt, Natalie, Hillary, Paul, and Peter. Anything surprising, Elizabeth?
Those were all pretty much on brand. I don't know. You might have some angry listeners after this, because they're pretty infectious.
Yeah, they are. Now, why on brand? I mean, what is it about that makes it an ear, a kind of a classic earworm?
Some songs really are catchier than others, and when people have tried to figure out what it is that makes a tune catchy, it tends to be pretty just singable enough. You could imagine singing it through in your head, like it sits nicely in your voice register, you know, all that. But it has just some little twist, some little surprise that is just very gripping and hooky. And it's not that, I mean, a whole wide range of things can get stuck in your head. So I know professional musicians who will have a Brahms symphony, you know, that's stuck in there. But generally, it's particular kinds of songs, like Who Let the Dogs Out, you know, things you don't necessarily want in your head.
Like the Muppet Babies song.
Muppet Babies thing particularly, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But all it takes, it seems, are a couple of notes, right?
Yeah. If you listen to a song, if you've listened to it recently, if you listen to it repeatedly, what we can do is just put you in kind of a low attentional state, like have you do the dishes or do some kind of task that doesn't require much attention. And, you know, more than half the time, little bits of the song that you've been hearing will pop into your head.
And you have done this to people.
I'm ashamed to say, yeah. But it really is a very natural, healthy, normal part of the memory consolidation process. It's good.
It's good. Well, let me play my most recent earworm, and this is Lady Gaga's Abracadabra. And this is basically the chorus. Let's give it a quick listen. That's catchy.
We were both nodding
while we were listening to that. Yeah. And we do know that the more people move while they're listening to a song, the likelier it is to get stuck in there.
Well, first of all, I mean, it is catchy. Let's just, whatever that is, you know, and the fact that we were both nodding. It also sounds familiar. So I felt like, God, I've heard this before.
Absolutely.
I don't know where. Yeah. And then looking at the music video, I mean, the dancing is just incredible. We were talking about movement. I mean, you know, that sort of cemented this song. But you know, there it is. There it goes. It's going around and around in my head.
Yeah, that's one of the things Karen is discovering, who I mentioned earlier, and that sometimes these imagined dance movements will get stuck in their head when people have seen it associated with a music video or something. Yeah.
So is it, I mean, so what is going on in our head?
So it turns out we're really doing this even more of the time than we know we're doing it. So one of the things we've done is a project led by Ben Cubitt, is try to figure out how you can detect earworms in an fMRI scanner. So how you can look at what's happening in someone's brain and say you were, you know, imagining who let the dogs out at this time point. And one of the interesting things he found as he was looking over his data set is, you know, not only do people seem to be experiencing earworms when they know they're experiencing them, but like things are going in their head kind of just below consciousness as well. And that the amount of times that people experience earworms to a particular song matter for how well they remember it a week or two later and how well they remember things that were going on while that song was playing.
Wow. I mean, is it the brain just sort of, I'm talking about the brain as if it's not connected to us, but the brain sort of just sort of deconstructing or entertaining itself with its earworms?
So replay is an important aspect of laying down, especially a memory that is sequential in this way. So music is really encoded such that each time point is really dependent on the previous one. So if I ask you something about midway through a melody, you have to kind of sing it through in your head from the beginning to get to that moment because it's really stored as a sequence.
Almost having a break here, but repetition is important in music too.
Exactly. That's part
of how
it gets.
You know, we go back to the chorus
Yes. And I think that's one of the most intriguing aspects of music is how come we're drawn again and again to this thing where we know exactly what's going to happen. We've already heard it, you know, 300 times when if it was like a book or a, you know, speech or something, we'd throw it across the room.
Right. I mean,
we heard it that many times.
We might read a book twice, but not 300
yeah.
times. Well, I'll tell you what, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation with Elizabeth Margulis. And we are kind of deconstructing music today on The Connection, talking about why it evokes such powerful and very specific memories, how it taps into our emotional life. And again, she's director of the Music Cognition Lab at Princeton University. Much more to talk about after this very short break, including some really fascinating research that she's been doing. We're going to play some more music as well. We'll be right back.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia, and again talking with Elizabeth Margulis about music. Just a quick follow-up. We were talking about earworms right before the break, and, you know, one can understand then why jingles and ads, you know, play on this earworm psychology.
Yeah, it's so sneaky. It can get a message into your head involuntarily.
Yeah, but using the same kind of rhythms and, I guess,
yeah, they're just piggybacking on this sequential learning and this kind of mental replay that you're doing to music.
Right.
Yeah.
Damn,
very sinister. Yeah.
Right, it is very sinister. Well, you've done some interesting research, and I'll have you describe it, but it's some cross-cultural investigations of music and I guess music and storytelling, but why don't you set it up for us and then we'll play a couple of pieces.
Sure. Well, one of the things that I had to really learn from students that I worked with, because I had started out brainwashed as a conservatory musician and didn't think about music in quite the same way, was that very often while they were listening, they were lapsing into some kind of daydream, or they were picturing some elaborate fictional scenario, or remembering some personal memory while they were hearing music that they hadn't heard before. And so this became a topic of interest, since it was not super familiar to me when they started describing it. And so we developed this paradigm where we could use natural language processing to analyze people's free response descriptions of these imaginings. So we didn't need to devise some elaborate task. We just let people tell us in their own words what they imagined.
What they imagined when they heard very specific pieces of music.
Exactly. And then what we found, interestingly, is that in specific places, if we played people a song they'd never heard before, and they were just listening by themselves and freely saying whatever came to mind, the same thing kept coming to mind.
No matter where they live?
For people in one place.
In one place.
But it could be quite different across places.
Oh, interesting. So
there really was this kind of shared imagining people were sustaining to, again, excerpts they had never heard before in their life, but it did not convey cross-culturally. So there's something about the lifetime of exposure and experiences you've had associated with music that is shaping how you make sense of even new music.
Well, let me play one of the pieces that you played for people in your research study. This is from Webern's String Quartet, Opus 28. We're going to just give a quick listen, we'll pull it down, and then we'll talk about it. So what kind of story, what kind of images, stories did people come? It's very provocative, I have to say.
Well, we had two groups of listeners in the U.S. One was in East Lansing, Michigan, and one was in Fayetteville, Arkansas. And they really pictured gruesome scenes to this music. They thought something terrible was happening, murder, sinister, extremely suspenseful. But we also had another group of participants in a rural village of Dong speakers in China, a village called Dimen. And there people had an equally coherent, shared sense of what that music was signifying. But for them, it was happily playing outside with friends.
Amazing.
And one of the things we think is going on there is that for the listeners in Arkansas and Michigan, just the fact that that excerpt is atonal is so, they cannot get past it. That just reads as really dark to them. Whereas the listeners in Demon didn't care as much about that and could cue into other things. Like there were these very short articulated notes and it was moving back and forth really quickly between a high register and a low register. And if you think about it, it's easy to see how that could seem quite playful. So it's not just that people have different interpretations of music depending on their culture. It's also that the attributes of the music they may be paying attention to most can change as a function of culture.
Which, of course, is the power of culture, right? To shape people's preferences and tastes.
Right. And that's part of what we think music does, right? Is say so much about, you know, your social identity and who you are and who you spent time with.
I remember hearing about Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, that when it was first played, I mean, some people said there were riots, but I think it was more hooting and hollering and booing and hissing. And you know, 100 years ago, that was considered very discordant or maybe atonal. Today, it's, you know, part of the repertoire. But it just shows you how music can evoke that stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, there are all kinds of examples that you could probably think of just in your own household, right, of generational shift in kind of sonic norms and what seems meaningful and moving.
Like screaming rock music, exactly. Things like that. Well, let me play another piece of music just to sort of underscore what we're talking about here. And again, this is part of the research you've been doing, and this is Liszt Faust Symphony. We'll give it a quick listen. Thank you. So what kind of images, stories did people tell you?
Well, not at all what Liszt would have thought, right? Because this isn't a movement titled Mephistopheles. But when we play this for listeners, actually across lots of different age groups in the U.S., we get the same response, which is that they picture a cartoon cat chasing a cartoon mouse. Despite that, this has never been played in a Tom and Jerry episode.
But it could be, I guess.
Yeah. But so what's interesting there is people will not, don't have, like, they can't say necessarily this is by Liszt and, you know, say all kinds of analytic things about the music. But when they say, when they picture Tom and Jerry, that's actually reflecting a lot of really sophisticated processing and category matching between what's happening in this music and other music that's been played in those kind of cartoons.
How about in China? Was China the other place where you played this?
Yes. And in China, I can't actually remember what the exact imagining was, but it was, I can assure you, it was not a cartoon cat and mouse. I can't recall for this particular excerpt. But yeah. And so per excerpts, we could just plot in semantic space from these natural language processing tools, where the average representation was for each song. And we'll see that the listeners from Arkansas and Michigan are so close to each other often as to overlap in this multidimensional representation of just meaning space. And the imaginings from the participants in Demon were often quite far.
Oh, that's so fascinating. But does it also tell us why movie music is so evocative?
Yes, 100%.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, just transporting in so many ways.
Yes, and there are excellent examples that you can find if you mess around on YouTube of people mismatching movie scenes with different soundtracks. And it's really stunning how much work the music is doing in terms of meaning making and emotional tone setting in movies. It's more than you think.
Well, one of my favorite scores is, or maybe my most favorite score is Ennio Morricone's score for Cinema Paradiso, which is just it does tug on your heartstrings, but then so does the movie. But I think just perfectly matches what's happening on the screen.
Yeah. And we have this great example that we use in my classes, which is the opening to the movie The Shining, which if you take away the Ligeti music that's playing in the background that has all these kind of Dies Irae quotes and it is, really, really dark.
Day of Wrath, yeah.
people think it's like a 70s documentary or like it's going to be a happy family movie or what have you. Yeah.
I love watching composers, with their orchestra or just conducting while the movie is going on. I mean, sort of like the olden days when there were silent movies.
Yes,
right?
That's an incredible art. I have a colleague who's amazing at this, who can accompany silent films with improv. And there's a whole bunch of like kind of stock phrases you can use, right, to kind of evoke certain kinds of scenes. And it's really amazing to watch it unfold in real time.
So based on your research, I mean, are there certain sad sad sounds? Is there something universal about, let's say, a minor key that can make people around the world feel a certain way? Or is it so culturally defined?
Yeah, all of these things layer into each other because there are certain things about what happens to our voice, for example, when we're sad, that because of this kind of low energy, certain things tend to happen, right? So you can mimic that in music, and that kind of mimicking tends to convey quite cross-culturally. But there are other things that really are quite dependent on very specific kinds of cultural exposures. Take mass media or something like that. So it's just a really fertile kind of place to look where you see all kinds of factors playing a role. That means that some things really work from place to place and others of them not at all.
But sort of hard to know which is which.
So it's hard to predict in advance which is which, although there are certain things like, just imagine like a startle reflex, like if you suddenly have a really loud sound, right? That's the kind of thing that has a particular kind of impression that's pretty invariant from place to place. But other things, even like consonants. So if you think about intervals that sound, harmonious together, people normally think those sound quite pleasant. If you look at this set of villages in the Amazon in Bolivia, where people do not sing together. They sing so they're used to just hearing one line at a time. If you take melodies that are common there and add another melody underneath at an interval that you might think is consonant, they don't think it's any more pleasant than, if you use an interval that's like really grating to my ear.
What's the difference between someone, let's say, has perfect pitch and someone who is, quote unquote, I don't know, should I say tone deaf? I mean, I don't know what the correct language is for that, but just cannot carry a tune.
Yes.
So, and is there a difference?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a difference. And many more people think they're tone deaf than actually are. There's a great tone deafness test online you can find and test yourself. But usually if you know you're singing badly, it's a production problem, but you know what the pitch should be. And that is not the same as tone deaf. But people who are tone deaf really cannot tell if you like mistune everything so that like, instead of it being like a Mozart sonata, it's like all, you know, a minor second apart and just crazy. Can't tell the difference.
Wow.
And that really, that is real and does afflict a significant percentage. It's like something like 5% of the population.
Just cannot tell the if it's in tune or out of tune.
Correct. And it's not, it doesn't affect speech prosody perception. So these people can still tell if I'm asking a question by making my voice go higher. So it's just this fine-grained pitch perception that is so important in music, but less relevant to speech. And then on the other side of things, people with absolute pitch, you can just, these are the people where there's like a vacuum on in the background and they're like, oh, your vacuum is an F sharp, right?
Wow.
And absolute pitch is actually a bit of a spectrum. So some people have it, really immediately and really robustly for all kinds of sounds. Some people have it more aligned with a particular instrument and they're slower if you go away from their instrument of expertise. And in fact, all of us have some kind of latent absolute pitch.
Oh,
so,
latent.
Exactly. So if I ask you to sing the chorus of Hotel California, for example, which I will not do.
Yeah.
But
I heard it in my head, though.
chances are you'd sing it on or pretty close to the actual pitch from the recording. So you do have some memory there of that. Or I could play you TV theme songs, either in their original version or slightly transposed upward or downward, and you would know which was the real one.
Oh, interesting. Interesting.
So we don't sometimes have access to it or to the labeling ability, but there is some kind of enhanced pitch representation more broadly than just in the absolute pitch group.
We talked earlier about music and cognition sort of broadly speaking, but I'm also thinking oftentimes when schools have to cut funding out, the window goes music and art and things like that. What is the connection, just like learning an instrument or singing in a chorus for, let's say, a seventh or eighth grader? How important is that for learning and for even helping in brain development?
Right. I mean, you can go at this argument from so many different angles about, the intrinsic worth of this musical experience.
Yeah.
But if you want to, if you're talking to someone who really is like, what about the math scores? you can point to lots of evidence that early musical training corresponds with reading ability several years later. And presumably this is because you actually are able to track aspects of the acoustic signal more accurately if you've had experience with learning about music. And that transfers over to segmenting the speech stream, abstracting phonemes out, and then you need to have that kind of phonemic awareness in order to be able to learn to read. So there's a lot of evidence about the relationship between musical training and reading ability. And then never mind executive function and other things.
Yeah. Let me squeeze in one more little piece of music. And this is something that connects with you, a musical memory for you. This is Franz Liszt, Les Preludes, which has a connection for you.
That's right. Should I share?
Well, let's play it and then you can share it. Yeah, go ahead. So So what does that bring back to you?
Well, every summer when I was growing up, I played the piano and I went to an 8-week art summer camp called Interlochen in Michigan. And for 100 years now, and the last day of that camp, they've had the orchestra play this exact piece and the dancers come and dance on the roof. And it's this whole tradition. And at the end of this performance, the conductor breaks the baton and that signifies the end of the summer. And I was very much a camp kid. I was all about the camp. So this is a very heartbreaking moment for me each summer. And now as an adult, even though I rarely think about high school or think about Interlochen or anything, if that music comes on in the background, at first I just feel really sad and I don't know why. And then I have to piece together, wait, that's Les Preludes. And
there you are, though. You're back. You're that teenage
Absolutely.
Person.
I'm sitting on the bench. Yes.
And the breaking of the baton, too.
That's cruel. Yeah. That's cruel to a 14-year-old.
It sure is. It sure is. Well, Elizabeth Margulis, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. And Elizabeth Margulis is director of the Music Cognition Lab at Princeton University. And thank you for joining us today on The Connection. The show airs every Friday and Sunday at noon right here on WHYY. You can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can also listen on the WHYY app. You can follow The Connection on Instagram and you can find us on Facebook. Also, check out our website, whyy.org/theconnection, for information about upcoming shows and to sign up for our newsletter. Our engineer today has been Al Banks. Debbie Builder produces The Connection with Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Thanks for joining us.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.